Chapter 40. Tilly.
Dear Miss Johns, it is with particular disappointment that I send you this letter, formally terminating the agency services agreement between you and Chenoweth, Taylor, and Reed. As you may recall, Section 13.4.3 of that agreement authorizes this firm, at its discretion, to withdraw from all representational obligations upon 30 days advance written notice. You should consider this letter such notice. I trust that the reasons for CTR's withdrawal will come as no particular surprise. I certainly do not feel compelled to recite them here. It should suffice to note that you have left us with considerable doubt as to your willingness to approach our relationship with the level of candor, honesty, and professionalism that we require of all our clients. Notwithstanding my specific efforts to impress upon you the mutual obligations entailed in an exclusive agency relationship, such as that which you have enjoyed with CTR, you have continued to act as your own agent in negotiating contracts for current projects without any consultation with me, Simon Hunter, or anyone else at CTR. I am sure you will understand and agree that we cannot continue to work for and advise you, or to pretend to work for and advise you, under such conditions. I remind you that CTR will enforce the terms of the agency services agreement, including collections of fees earned or otherwise owed, in connection with all contracts signed and media appearances made by you incident to such contracts, from the date you executed the CTR agency services agreement up through the 30th day following the date of this letter. Such contracts include, but are not necessarily limited to, those signed in connection with Price Point and the Lion Tree. Simon Hunter will be in contact periodically and as necessary to ensure that your ongoing obligations to CTR are fully satisfied. Failure to cooperate in any respect will necessitate legal action, an expensive and time-consuming distraction we would all do well to avoid. In the meantime, Tilly, while I am immensely disappointed in this turn of events, I do wish you the best of luck in your career. Your current choices notwithstanding, I hope you continue to move forward and upward. Yours, Milton A. Chenoweth. He was right, of course. The letter had not been a surprise. From the moment, just before 3 a.m, that I began dialing Blair Gaines' number to tell him that I wanted the part of Ivanova, I knew that I would need to be looking for a new agent. I could have made an effort to salvage the relationship. I could have told them about my decision, rather than letting them hear about it from other sources. I could have insisted that Blair and Brightleaf Studios negotiate a new deal with Chenoweth, Taylor, and Reed, exacting another pound of flesh as a precondition to my involvement in the Lion Tree, after the inconvenience of having to audition twice, and for having to juggle my career around the uncertainty of the project. Milton might have forgiven my impulsiveness as long as, in the end, I had let CTR do the talking and squeeze another penny or two out of Blair. That, in any event, would have been preferable to what I actually did, which was to meet Blair Gaines for a martini and agree without any resistance that no changes to the initial agreement I had signed were necessary. But the truth was that the prospect of salvaging my relationship with CTR seemed too expensive. It would have required an obeisance to Milton Chenoweth, a man who had pledged to treat me as he would his own daughter. He had every reason not to trust me. I had lied to him about the second audition, not because my motivations were complicated and my mind was confused, as I had suggested to Milton and Simon, and as I had even allowed myself to believe. The truth was that I had lied to Milton because, through no fault of his own, he was an unwitting archetype and a surrogate. My agent, as it turned out, was also an agent of sorts for my father. They had never met or spoken, but they occupied the same space in my head. After years of retrospection, I concluded that seeking Milton's approval, or even his advice, entailed a kind of metaphoric death, a surrendering of my own will. In that paternal way of his, Milton had made the mistake of communicating his disapproval. For Blair. For Angus. For the Lion Tree. That disapproval, that judgment, and all the bad choices and moral failings on which it was based, defined me. Milton's disapproval of the film pushed me toward the Lion Tree almost as much as Angus Mann's disapproval of me pulled me in. Of course, the irony was that, far from protecting my own will, I was ceding its authority to nearly everyone who had a strong opinion. Milton's letter arrived, appropriately enough, on the day that I was scheduled to meet with the principals of the Lion Tree for a work session with the new script. Perhaps because the letter was foremost in my mind that day, I remember little about the actual meeting. I do remember that the session was conducted in the largest of the Brightleaf studio conference rooms, around an enormous ovate table made of rosewood with inlays of dark green granite in the shape of leaves and vines strewn across its surface. I was late to the meeting. I remember looking at the faces around the table and being shocked that there were only two of them that I recognized. Blair Gaines, who sat at one end of the table, and Angus Mann, who sat at the other end. I sat in the only empty chair, at the exact midpoint of the table, before a bound copy of the screenplay, a blank notepad, pens, two bottles of water, and a pre-printed paper nameplate. The nameplate read, Colonel Elena Ivanova. Conversation stopped as I made my apology and took my seat. Blair introduced me to the others, real name followed by character name, each of whom in turn nodded or raised a hand.
"And down there at the end is Angus," said Blair. "Not much of an actor, if you ask me, but he's had a bit of a role in the script."
The others laughed at the understatement. Angus looked up. In the sense of rotating his eyes in their sockets, from fiddling with his pen. His lips tightened perceptibly from within the plush of his short silvery beard, in a way that I knew was his best effort at a smile. "Angus," I said with a polite nod, "I won't be making a habit of being late."
Now, Matilda," he said. "Don't go changing your habits on my account. If everyone tried to monkey up their habits, I'd never know who anyone was."
More laughter, the others bearing witness to a playful banter that they each assumed had developed between the writer and the only survivor of the Great Cast Massacre. We had a history, Angus and Blair and I. The three of us were the camp counselors, with all our secrets and inside jokes, at which the new arrivals could only guess and wonder. I laughed along, pretending to be oblivious to the irritation and contempt that I heard, like a dog whistle, in Angus's tone. The session resumed. We read through the scenes in order, with Blair breaking in incessantly to provide a directorial context, unconsciously connecting his thumbs and forefingers into a mock viewfinder to focus his thoughts. As might be expected, the session was heavily weighted on my exchanges with the man seated directly across from me, Stuart Glenn, the new Lieutenant Alan Miller. Stuart sat in stark contrast to Casey Travern, his lean, glossy, dark-eyed predecessor. He had sandy hair, Atlantean eyes, and an open, slightly doughy face that would certainly miss out on Casey Travern's disproportionately adolescent demographic. For all appearances, Lieutenant Miller had metamorphosed from someone who looked as though he might have some expertise in the sexual arts, and who also might be capable of serial murder, to someone for whom sexual expertise and violence seemed equally implausible. The emotional calculation and potential menace implied by the precision of Casey's face had been replaced with an undeniable sweetness and the innocence of good intentions. I recall liking Stuart instantly. He was every bit Casey's equal as an actor, with half the pretension and twice the intellect.
"I want to go back,"
he said in a whisper, leaning across the table.
"I want to start over. Colonel? L?
You can't go back."
"Yes,
no. You can't start over."
"I mean, I want to start over with you. I want that feeling we shared. Remember the launch? L, do you? Look at me. Remember the feeling in your chest? Like something breaking open. Like something blooming inside you for the first time. Remember? After that first count sequence? After the last burn? It was just the two of us, floating. No sound, no earth, no others, no history. Just us. Lieutenant, I want to go back to that, L.
Alan,
I want us to go back to that feeling.
There is no going back.
You loved me. You love me still, I know that. And I love you.
No. You don't love me. You never did. You can't go back to something that never existed in the first place.
I love you, L.
You love leaving, Alan. That's who you are.
No.
Yes. That feeling in your chest, that glorious blooming, that was your lust for leaving.
That's not true.
That was escape.
You're wrong.
There is no love, Alan. Not for you. There is only a prelude to leaving. You can't conceive of a love that doesn't end. And unless you find some way to end it first, then your life has no meaning. Your love carries the seed of its own destruction. It comes with a poison pill.
Jules killed herself, Elena.
And your unborn daughter. Just like you knew she would. Just like you hoped.
No. She was sick.
Sick? You think I haven't read the reports? She was heart sick, Alan. She'd lost everything. Her parents, her sister, you were all that she had left. You and her illicit fetus. Was it your idea to make her a felon? Was she that in love with you? Did you counterfeit the birth waiver, or did she?
That's not...
How long had you been grooming her? You got to her just in time, didn't you? Did you pull her out of line at the clinic and take her out for a soda?
Oh.
Did you impress her with your Unix Rocket Man credentials? Did you convince her to skip that rite of passage into womanhood from provisional infertility to permanent sterility? Did you tell her the penalty?
You don't understand, Elle.
And then, right before disappearing from her life, you told her about us.
She deserved to know.
And I didn't?
It was over. I didn't think.
You thought plenty, Alan. You told her, making more of me than you had any right to, knowing what that would mean. And then you signed up for an 8-ball on Ruton Baker. That's a long time for someone about to be a brand new father. You should have been denied clearance. You lied on your review.
You don't understand.
You knew she was fragile.
No.
You gave her the pills.
I gave her a prescribed medication. I picked it up for her.
Still in the unopened zip pack. Downstairs. In the bathroom. That's not what was in the glass. The glass with your biosig, Alan. It's been dated to the half minute.
Of course I handed her the glass. But it was only water. I've told you that. We've been through all this.
Yes, we have.
Why would I do such a monstrous thing? I loved her.
Oh. You mean, like you love me?
No, not like I love you. Is that it? You think I could do that to you? Abandon you? Poison you?
I couldn't. You could. You will, if I let you.
Why? Why would I?
Because that's your lion tree, Alan. You're always going to go back to that understanding, that identity.
My lion what? What understanding?
You're not the one left behind. That terrifies you. You're the lever. Who was the one who first set this sickness in motion, Alan? She must have been something. I'm guessing your mother.
Elle.
Was there a wife before Jules? Someone else you haven't told me about?
I love you. You. That's my only understanding about anything.
My uncle was a forensic mentalist for the military. A good one. Before that, he was in private practice. He liked to tell stories to his patients. You know, old parables. And then he liked to recast the stories so that his patient was somewhere in the middle, He'd stop and let the patient finish telling the story. He said it helped them figure out why they did the things they did.
Elena, please. We're running out of time. I need you to...
The lion tree story was one of his favorites. You know lions, Alan?
Yes. L. I know what lions were. I passed natural history.
The lion tree story starts with a family. A mother and father and two children. One boy and one girl. That was important, because it allowed a lot of opportunity to use the story with all kinds of different patients. It worked with men and women of all ages. Anyway, this family takes a trip to what was then a place called Kenya, on the continent of Africa. They went for a safari. A safari was like a...
I know what safaris were, Elena.
Yes. Well, it was nothing like the Africa we knew. It was a living continent then, teeming with life. The whole thing was inhabitable. The father was a big game hunter and photographer. He wanted pictures of the wildlife, elephants and giraffes and water buffalo, but especially the lions. So he hired guides and spent 2 weeks roaming the baking savannas with his family, camping and taking pictures. One day,
Elena, it's almost time. I'm begging you, don't do this, even if I deserve it. Don't give in to that uniform. You're not a heartless person. Take me with you. It's a long trip back. We'll work things out. I'll explain everything. If you still aren't persuaded, I'll take my chances with eunuchs. I'll prove my innocence. The science can be wrong. Even if I'm convicted, I'll feel better if you're not the one executing me.
One day, as the sun was setting, the group set up camp beneath a cluster of large trees. They were called acacias. They had canopies that looked like layers of green clouds, casting pools of shade across the dry, hot grasses of the savanna. Wouldn't you give just about anything to live in a time when you could see wild trees? Just to stroll up to one and sit under it and watch the sun looking for you all afternoon?
No. But I would give just about anything to take your hand in my hand.
Then, when it was completely dark and everyone was in their tents, the lions came. And,
okay, cut, cut.
Blair interrupted, pushing his hands out over the table.
Let me stop you there. Stuart, I'm gonna be coming in real tight in this scene, okay? I mean, right in your face. Your eyes are gonna fill the damn screen by the time we get to the end of it. You're really gonna have to emote from the bridge of your nose up, okay?
Stuart nodded simply, as if people were always asking this of him.
It's all in the eyes. Voice calm, body calm, but the eyes need to be intense. Time is running out for you. She's about to leave you on this fucking rock, okay? She's taken all the miners and other workers with her. The experiment is a bust. Ruton Baker is non-sustainable. So everyone is bugging out except you. You're staying. The sweet talk hasn't worked.
Blair jabbed a thumb in my direction.
She's turning out to be tough as nails and cold as ice.
and she's about to leave you to your greatest terror, which is to be abandoned. Alone. For a fucking eternity.
Or until the food runs out.
Stuart quipped.
Food? Fuck the food. You've got enough provisions to last 10 lifetimes. It's sanity that's going to be in short supply. And you bloody well know it, as she's telling you this story of hers. So, I need your expression to transition smoothly from the hopelessness of love through the pain of accusation and then down into a creeping despair. And by the time I'm ready to widen the shot, and I'm going to go really wide on this one, I want terror to have taken over those baby blues. Okay?
Stuart nodded, taking notes.
Tilly?
Blair said, turning to me.
I know this is a dry run, and a rough one at that. The set work will pull everyone into the moment. But try your best to guard against sounding glib and superior.
I found myself missing the old days, when Blair, in an effort to cover our sexual entanglement, would have barked savagely at me to
stop being so goddamn glib and superior.
From that first moment of what Blair liked to call the second go, he was so grateful to have me on board that every criticism was delivered with extra padding.
This is not a victory for Lena, he continued. She's still making up her mind, even as she is talking to this guy. This is a big fucking thing she's about to do to him, okay? She loves him, and they both know it. So, this isn't easy. Miller's gonna go mad, or kill himself, or both, before he sees another human. So, we need to hear that weight in your voice. We need to hear this rigorously restrained, emotional conflict in every syllable. Life and death. That means,
I need to slow it down. Not so fast.
That's exactly it. Slow it down. Pour some lead in there. We're going to be hearing your words and watching Miller react. I'm doing a slow fade out from Miller, a slow fade into the Africa footage, and a slow fade back to Miller's face. And all the while, you are telling this story, okay? So, be thinking about voice, tone, pacing, he's sight, your sound. Got it?
My cell phone buzzed. Zach was calling. It would wait. I rejected the call. I can do that, I said, trying my best to sound neither glib nor superior.
Good. All right then. Angus, anything to add from your end?
There was a painfully long delay. We all looked at Angus, who was alone at the far end of the table, drawing slow hash marks on his pad. His face was pinched in some secret torment. One by one, the others looked away. Blair and I looked at each other.
So, okay, said Blair. Let's turn to the...
You think she's immoral?
The sound came from Angus. He had not looked up.
Who? Tilly John? Well, of course she's immoral, Angus. Haven't you been reading the newspapers? Good God, man! Why do you think I've hired her?
There was a cloudburst of mirth around the table, with none laughing louder than Blair. I feigned annoyance. Angus did not flinch. Silence restored itself with an unnatural rapidity, pushing the laughter off a cliff.
Blair sighed and took a drink of water, obviously wishing it were something stronger. I felt momentarily sorry for him. I could only imagine how many of the conversations like the one he was about to have he had endured with Angus over the course of the filming. I found his patience with Angus astounding, particularly given Blair's normal disposition with respect to those who would deign to wrest his authority over any aspect of a project.
"I'm only joking, Angus. I know you didn't mean Tilly."
"So then," said Angus, reversing the slant of the hash marks to make a herringbone pattern that ran the width of the page.
The unfinished statement hung in the air, becoming a question. Blair looked sideways at me and rubbed his face with one hand.
"Right. So, immoral. Do I think Ivanova is immoral? I'd have to answer yes. In a way, she's as immoral as Miller is. I mean, she does to Miller what Miller did to Jules, right? She's operating on essentially the same egocentric behavioral principle. Abandon, lest ye be abandoned. That's what makes it so damned intriguing. On the one hand, she's obviously imposing judgment, but in doing so, she becomes just like Miller. And this is not at all lost on Miller, who suggests that she's a heartless executioner. He's suddenly in a position to judge her just as harshly as she judges him."
Angus did not respond.
"But something tells me you're going to tell me I'm all wet, as usual. So, let's have it. Can you defend her decision?"
Angus shook his head, almost sadly.
"This is not a morality tale, Blair. The morality of Ivanova's decision does not concern me. The morality of Miller's conduct does not concern me. I don't care if what they have done is justified or reprehensible. What you say is certainly true to a point, but it is irrelevant."
He fell back into silence, contemplative and brooding. My phone buzzed again. Zach again. I rejected it again. Angus looked up at the phone on the table, glowering.
"Look," said Blair. "I know from experience that you're gonna tell me, Angus. So just tell me and we can move on."
Angus continued his doodling in silence until I thought he was not ever going to respond. Then he looked up at me, ignoring Blair, and spoke as if it had always been our conversation, as if we were back beneath the moon in Kenya, outside the hotel by the elephant fountain. Just the two of us.
"We live in circles. We keep coming back to the same place, again and again and again, like a scratch in a record that keeps our needle from following in a continuous groove, skipping us back to the place we started. And we keep coming back to that scratch, that flaw, that scar on the human psyche, that thing, that word, that look, that event. Whatever it is that we cannot let go, the thing that has come to define us. It is the place where we were born. Not our bodies. Our identities."
No one moved or spoke. Angus generally said so little that, whenever he did speak,
especially when he chose to string entire sentences together. People listened.
It's not a tale of morality. It's a tale of identity. See, we eventually become the scar. It's not simply part of who we are. It defines us. We become the thing in our past that we cannot let go. Who is Lieutenant Miller? He is the man abandoned. At some impressionable moment in his life, he was abandoned. Perhaps literally left to die by someone he loved. That is his scar. That is the skip in the record, and it defines him completely. He spends his entire life replaying that moment. Every relationship, every emotional connection is a self-defeating proposition. The more important the relationship, the more it lives in the shadow of abandonment, fraught with the certainty of dissolution and heartbreak. So he picks with uncanny precision women without enough fortitude to stick it through. They all ultimately get fed up and leave him, reinforcing his identity.
Not Jules, I said.
No. Jules hangs in there. She's there for the distance, which threatens everything Alan Miller has come to believe about himself. She represents for him a kind of self-annihilation. Of course, on the other side of that annihilation is a new person. On the other side of annihilation, the needle of the self finds a new groove and life continues onward. But that is not how we are wired. We cling to what we know about ourselves. We protect it at any cost, even if it kills us. Because we are who we are. And so, how does Alan Miller respond to Jules, the woman who threatens to disrupt the pattern? By beating fate to the punch. By prematurely cutting the ties with her and anyone else who would love him. And where does this leave him? But alone and heartbroken, abandoned by his own hand. Right back to the skip in the record.
And Ivanova? I asked. Angus waited a beat, looking at me.
You tell me,
he said. Blair looked at his watch and collapsed back in his chair. When I looked over at him, he held up his hands and shook his head with a laugh of futility.
No, no, he said. You two go right ahead. I've nothing better to do than be a fly on the wall at an English-lit social.
The comment was more perceptive than Blair knew. I really did feel as though I was back at Wesleyan, dissecting some great work of fiction in an empty room with the professor long after the class has been dismissed. Miller is now Ivanova's scar, I offered at last. The skip on her record. He's now the thorn lodged in her psyche. She loves him. Leaving him is the thing she will never be able to let go. She'll always come back around to that moment. If Miller thinks of himself as judged and abandoned, then Ivanova will now identify herself as the one who judges and abandons the one she loves. They're flip sides of the same coin. And she'll look to recreate the event and reinforce the pattern. Just as Miller does.
Yes. Yes. How?
I thought for a moment, putting myself into Ivanova's head, back on Earth with Miller alone. a million miles away and devouring himself from the inside out, with nothing but my accusing words in his head. First, she'll reinforce by avoidance. She'll steer clear of meaningful relationships. Those relationships she chooses, she won't commit to, forcing a kind of, I guess, a kind of emotional indifference, hoping the other person will drift away on his own. A little like Louis de Pointelac in Interview with a Vampire, feeding on rats, precisely because he knows what he is, but not wanting to be that thing. It's avoidant self-denial that actually ends up reinforcing identity.
Good,
said Angus.
Excellent. But that won't hold, will it?
No. Eventually, there will be relationships. Potentially successful ones, with people whom she loves and who will love her in return. But she won't feel worthy of those relationships. She'll act in outrageous or disagreeable ways, wanting to be judged and rejected for what she did to Miller.
Yes. Why?
Because the thing she can't get past is her own guilt. She'll live to be judged. The harsher, the better. That's the only thing she will want. She won't feel worthy of love. It's the guilt that defines her now.
What does she have to feel guilty about?
Leaving Miller, I said.
That's the minor note,
said Angus.
What's the major chord?
I was stumped. He waited. They all did. I could feel Blair's eyes on me. If he was bored and annoyed before, he seemed riveted now. I had impressed him, but I was stuck. I could not tell Angus what he was after. He was leaning forward in his chair, his eyes boring into me. I don't know. Leaving Miller to die. Leaving Miller to rot with his own guilt in his worst nightmare, alone in space on a deserted planet.
No.
Angus was suddenly irritated and impatient.
You're repeating yourself.
Then what? Angus looked around the table from one blank stare to the next. He came back to me. His eyes had taken on a pleading quality. He wanted me to understand.
The judgment itself,
he said.
It was Ivanova's own judgment that crushed Miller. This person who loved her. This person who had found his way through the stiff, unforgiving uniform to the soft humanity inside. The guilt starts there. That's the origin of the heart's betrayal. The rest follows purely as a matter of consequence. Ivanova will feel guilty forever for judging him.
Expiation, I said, smiling because I could not resist it. Everything from now on will be about expiation. Judge me. Forgive me. For I have judged without forgiveness, as though Miller was still with her, and there was something left to salvage. Angus leaned back in his chair, cocking his head to one side, regarding me as if in a new light.
Love will not be banished,
he said,
nor longing consumed. fates reserved for the heart and the will.
I sat staring at him, stunned, shocked to hear my own words.
The words on my audition form, repeated back to me by the author himself.
He had committed them to memory. He had held on to them, tucking them away in his mind. He had waited for an opportunity to speak them back to me. I felt naked and embarrassed.
I began to blush, and the room felt suddenly stifling. It took a moment to realize that no one else in the room had any reason to believe those words had come from me. No one else had any reason to know that Angus was conducting a conversation in a code that only I could understand. Not that I knew what he was trying to tell me. I really had no idea. But it was clear that he was trying to connect with me and only me. It was clear that he actually wanted to connect. And that idea was completely contrary to what I had imagined, which was that interacting with me beyond what was absolutely essential to conducting business, Blair's business, a business he hated and that was anathema to his entire professional existence, was the last thing he wanted. It was beginning to dawn on me that almost more than anything else, Angus wanted to be understood, and that I was somehow better at that than anybody else at his disposal.
"Well,"
said Blair in a tone of retaking control,
"if you two are quite done."
The meeting trundled on for far too long. Late in its third hour, my cell phone began vibrating its way across the table. That was Blair's cue to call it quits for the day. Everyone stood as I answered. Angus exited the conference room without so much as a word or backward glance. I looked at the phone, surprised. "Simon?" Blair looked down at me, suddenly interested. I nodded and drew a slow finger across my throat.
"Tills," said Simon, "can you talk?"
"I can now. What's up?"
I don't know if you've heard."
Simon's voice was like someone walking on broken glass in bare feet.
"I received Milton's termination letter, Simon,"
I said, still looking at Blair,
"this morning."
Blair held out both his middle fingers and pointed them at the phone.
"Oh, yes. God, this is terribly awkward on so many levels. That was not my choice. But Milton, he has a lot of pride about these things."
"Don't worry about it, Simon. I probably had that one coming. No hard feelings."
Blair rolled his eyes in disgust and left me alone.
"That's big of you, Tills. Really."
"Not at all. I suppose you'll be wanting to get together to make sure you're getting a good paper trail on my two current projects."
"No," he said. "I know what the letter said, but I'm not an accountant, and I'm not comfortable being an enforcer. Not even for Milton Chenoweth. Have your new agent call me. Let's work it that way. I'll tell Milton everything is copacetic."
"Fine," I said. "Easy enough. Thanks."
"But..."
His voice is cringing. The bits of glass are still underfoot.
"But what?"
God.
Simon, what?
We do need to meet, Tills. Not for all of that nonsense, but for something else. Are you free? Like, now?
Now? Yeah, I guess. Simon, what the hell?
I've got some news you're not going to like, he said.
What news?
It'll be better if we talk about this in person, Tills. Martinis at the ready.
Jesus, Simon! You can't leave me hanging. Give me a fucking headline.
There was a pause, with only the wind of the freeway blowing into Simon's telephone.
Okay, he said, sounding trapped. Fuck all. This just in. Young starlet, struggling with professional image, hit with fucking sex tape scandal at worst fucking possible time.
What?
My own voice sounded alien.
A what? Photos at 11.